Thanks, everyone, for coming out. This is Cargo Shipping's Clean Energy Challenge, and I'm excited to have my panelists here. We have folks visiting from the West Coast, from the Great Lakes, so should be a really interesting national, global, local discussion. My name is Maria Gallucci. I am a freelance journalist, and until a few weeks ago, I was the Energy Journalism Fellow at the University of Texas in Austin. And as part of that fellowship, I focused very intensively on reporting and writing about clean energy development in cargo shipping. And through the course of that reporting, got to know some of these panelists and hear about the exciting projects that they're working on. So I wanted to bring that to SEJ to talk about not only the solutions, but also the challenges in this massive industry that I think often is a side note to the larger discussions on climate change and energy development. So to get started, I'll have my panelists, we can just go down the line, introduce yourselves and talk about some of the projects you're working on.
Sure. My name is Joe Pratt. I've been involved with hydrogen fuel cells and maritime. For first time I started looking at this was as an undergraduate at University of Washington, which unfortunately was more than 20 years ago now. I worked most recently at Sandia National Laboratories, focused on hydrogen fuel cells and two aspects of that. One is fueling stations for the vehicles that are coming out on the road. And then the other one is fuel cells in maritime. I see through that work, saw a strong business case for providing hydrogen fuel cell solutions for powertrains. So in January, I left Sandia, started a new company called Golden Gate Zero Emission Marine, and that's who I'm representing today to commercialize it out, starting in the North American market. With Maria's permission, I wanted to just briefly describe what a fuel cell is. I won't ask if you're familiar with one. Just think of a fuel cell as a series of plates that make electricity. It's very much like a battery. There's a chemical reaction. So you have a plate, and it's coated on both sides with some kind of a catalyst. The hydrogen comes in this side. It hits the catalyst and splits apart. Part of the hydrogen proton goes through the middle of the plate, the electron gets stripped off and goes out to turn your motor, comes back to the other side, combines with air, the oxygen in the air, and makes water. So that's it. There's no moving parts. You just have hydrogen on one side, oxygen on the other side, making electricity. What is hydrogen? Very quickly, it's very much like natural gas. It's a fuel. 80% of natural gas, roughly, is hydrogen, CH4 in methane. So the practices and everything been developed for safety around natural gas is very applicable to hydrogen. There's about 30 million kilograms of hydrogen produced and used every day in the United States. So it's old technology. People understand it. It's just new to maritime.
Great. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. My name is Chris Wolf, and I work for Environmental Defense Fund. EDF is a nonprofit, non-governmental organization focused on environmental advocacy, and we do our work with science, economics, the law, and through partnerships with organizations like companies and other organizations like that. The work that I've done for EDF has been primarily around port facilities. Goods movement is one of the big areas that we focus on because of the air quality impacts to communities that live near ports. At a given port, I focus on mobile sources. And so there's five key mobile sources. There's the ocean-going vessels. There's harbor craft that support those ocean-going vessels and do other things around the harbor. Switcher locomotives, which are used to move goods in either bulk or containers to other parts of the country. Cargo handling equipment. And then there are drayage trucks. And of those five sources, the biggest one that we've not been able to do anything about has been ocean-going vessels. And so this is a really important topic to be talking about because even though ocean-going vessels, container ships, are very efficient on a carbon dioxide ton per mile for the cargo units, they're very polluting in ports, resulting in, if you look at a port's emissions inventory, over 50% of the particulates and the NOx at a port are emitted by the ships. And so thinking about ways to reduce those localized impacts and the hot spots that they're creating is really important. So that's a lot of the work that I do.
Thanks. Morning. My name's Dennis Donahue. I work for NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So I'm with a federal agency. For the past 20 years, I've led what we've called the Green Ship Initiative, and that's primarily to focus on environmentally responsible best management practices, which obviously would include fuels for the marine environment. My day job is I manage the Great Lakes research fleet for NOAA, and I help manage NOAA's research vessels on the coast as well. About 19 years ago, part of this effort was to look at how biofuels might come into play to reduce emissions and lessen our footprint on the marine environment. The path that we went down that time was to go with B100. So we're not using a blended product. Currently we're on 100% soybean oil, but we've worked with algae-based biofuels as well as sugar-based biofuels and all kinds of waste products that were eventually converted to biofuels. So our focus has been to explore how biofuels can be used in the marine environment and mainly to solve the logistic problems associated with that and many of the technical problems so that we can use biofuels in existing power plants without significant capital investment.
Thank you. Well, that kind of goes on into the next question I was going to ask. Maybe each of you could discuss some of the hurdles that are unique to the shipping industry when we think about how to replace those massive diesel engines and the very cheap, ubiquitous bunker fuel, the heavy fuel oil that many of them use. What about, you know, compared to, say, electricity on land or ground transportation, what is unique to the maritime industry and how does that make it kind of how does that come into play with clean energy development?
You want me to start?
Sure, yeah.
Compared to land vehicles, it's much more difficult to use batteries, I would say. So there's different options if you want to clean up a ship. You can go to cleaner burning diesel, you can go to hybrid, you can go to LNG, and then you could go to 100% zero emission. And of course, with the combustion options, getting into different biofuels. On land, if you want to power a car with battery, it's pretty straightforward. We see that, you know, the automakers have cars that can do that right now. And there are certain use cases for vessels where it does make sense to use a battery, kind of shorter runs, smaller, slower boats actually work pretty well if you have the shoreside infrastructure. But there is a limit on what batteries can do. For example, you can't move a container ship across the globe with the battery. It's just not enough space or a displacement allowance on those. So that in that case, if you want to get rid of emissions entirely, really the only option right now is hydrogen fuel cells. We did a study when I was still at Sandia that looked at all the vessels, not all of them, a case study of 14 vessels in the world's fleet, from small fishing boats up to large container ships, and found that all of those could be powered by zero emission equipment, whether it's batteries or fuel cells.
So I guess one thing that I would say is that the shipping industry is very much a globalized industry. And in the U.S., if we use sort of the on-road vehicle industry to compare, the U.S. government saw back in the 1970s that, you know, if we install things like catalytic converters, that would improve emissions, improve the air that we breathe. And so those types of regulatory frameworks helps industry have a goal to then innovate and bring new technologies to the market. In a globalized sector like shipping, that's really challenging. And what we end up with is something that I think is really difficult, because the shipping industry is governed by treaty, right? Ships, the International Maritime Organization, sort of promulgates through international treaty the requirements that are applicable to the ships that sail the seas. And so if you have local areas trying to achieve policy goals like clean energy, you may be moving ships from one port to another, creating hotspots, taking away the economic benefits that are coming to an area, moving them elsewhere. And you're creating this regulatory patchwork that is really difficult for the industry to innovate to respond to plan for.
Certainly, I support both those comments. The thing that I would add, too, is that the maritime industry is very traditional, very slow to change. It is global, so you have all of the global politics associated with it. The challenges are this perception of risk, a huge capital investment. There is a resistance to change unless there is a high certainty that it will be a good business decision. We're also putting capital and people in harm's way, unlike an over-the-road mode of transportation, where when things go wrong, you pull off to the side and you call AAA and... you know, once you're at sea or even in coastal waters, you are putting people at risk. So I think we have to address that, this perception of added risk. And then the last thing that I would add is, along with the new technologies, we have to build the infrastructure to support that. So we need, whether it's a fueling option, we need fueling sites on both ends of that transit. We also, the higher technology things, we have to have the technicians and the companies and the supplier network to support that, those new technologies. Otherwise, I think the industry will view it as being an exceptional high-end risk, a little bit outside the box.
Yeah, and so in April, the International Maritime Organization adopted a goal. They're going to work toward establishing an actual policy to reduce emissions from the global industry by 50% compared to 2008 levels by 2050. And part of that, I think that the big reason proponents are pushing for it was to create this, to stimulate this innovation and to kind of push the industry in a certain direction it might not be compelled to take otherwise. Maybe you could speak to any of you speak to the role that policy, maybe other policies as well, have in driving innovation in a sector that doesn't have much incentive to change, or it's difficult to change because it's so massive. Like you said, it's so global.
Me first, sure, again? Yeah. Okay, great.
Keep it easy.
You're doing well.
I was looking at this a couple weeks ago. The first cargo ship on the water was something like 3000 BC. And since then, there's been no air emissions regulations until about 1997. So it's about 5,000 years of no air emissions regulations. And over the past 20 years, IMO has put in at least 8 different new regulations. So you clearly see a shift in, before, the shift in energy consumption for shipping was based on the benefits. So from oars to wind to coal to oil, and now we're seeing another shift to clean fuels, which nobody's quite sure what that's going to be over the next 30 years, but it's going to cleaner diesel, it's going to biodiesel, it's going to LNG, and people are starting to think about things like battery electric and hydrogen. So the regulations play a big part in this new shift. I think the effect of that April announcement remains to be seen what the practical effect of that is. But what it's done is it's thrown a very respected organization has said this is what we want to do. And so people like me can point to that and say this is credible when we say the world is switching to the maritime world is switching to cleaner ways of propulsion. It's not just us kind of talking about it. The only other thing I want to add is I wouldn't discount the efforts and the impact of local regulation and local initiatives. It's very difficult, as the speakers mentioned, to build out a clean worldwide shipping industry from day one. But when you start locally in certain regions and you build out from there, now one region has the infrastructure, the fuel, whatever available. Now another one does over here, and you start building these, and soon you can start doing the ocean going part also. So that's kind of the progress I see. And that also follows the business case, where the smaller, more regional vessels have a business case right now. The ships are maybe in about 5 years, which can help drive it besides the regulations.
So I guess I would add that in the greater context of the announcement that came in April, so back with the Paris climate talks, there was a lot of momentum and some really great outcomes, but two sectors were left off at the table, not making commitments, and that was the aviation sector and the shipping sector. Aviation came toward, announced that they would commit to greenhouse gas reductions much earlier than the shipping sector did. And so finally in April, IMO came out with something that, in my view, waiting till 2050 to put something in place, that's way far out there, and it's could be something that could have been 2040 and could have pushed the industry a little bit more. But we have it, and I agree wholeheartedly with Joe that is something that is needed to provide an endpoint or a midpoint for transitioning the sector to a much cleaner way of doing business.
There's an advantage to being last, because I can play off of what they said. It's yet to be seen how this will take shape and take form. But the thing that I want to echo what Joe said is I hope we play off of local regulation and local success stories. And I'm going to give you two examples of that. Up here on the Great Lakes, we've been at zero discharge for 30 years.
Can you clarify what you mean by zero discharge?
Zero discharge. Nothing is pumped off the ship and into the waters that it's operating in. We've been that way for 30 years. To go to the ocean sector and say, hey, you need holding tanks, you can't offload this, even beyond 3 or 10 or 20 miles from shore, they can't comprehend that. So there is an answer. We have 1,000-foot ships on the Great Lakes that have zero discharge. Some of the upcoming regulation is calling for low sulfur, zero sulfur fuels. There's been fleets operating on zero sulfur for 20 years based on local regulations and local initiatives. So as IMO and some of these global organizations, national organizations are doing the right thing, I hope that we don't lose sight of some of the local regulations and local success stories, because in those areas are the answers globally, I believe.
Shifting the focus a little bit to ports, Chris, I wondered if you could talk a bit about the work EDF is doing specifically around trying to kind of framing port communities as environmental justice communities and trying to better understand the link between the pollution from ships and the effects on the people who live kind of in the shadow of those ports.
Sure. So a lot of the work I do is down in Texas at the Port of Houston. And one of the really interesting projects we've been leading down there is something that is taking advantage of technologies that ships are required to be using and then trying to translate that into what the impacts are for the communities that are nearby. So the Houston Ship Channel is essentially a 50-mile ship channel that ships traverse as they come in from the Gulf of Mexico and come to the public or private terminals at the Port of Houston. Ships have been required to use a technology called Automatic Information Systems, or AIS, for a number of years, and you can think about this as just GPS for ships. What we're doing is we're taking that data, those data that are generated frequently from ships, and the Houston Ship Channel, there's between 7,000 and 8,000 transits every year. It's a very busy ship channel. But what we've done is we've taken that data from AIS, and we've linked that back to all ships have to register specific data with organizations that track when those ships were built. And so we have an idea on when those engines were put into those vessels. And so we can estimate the emissions. With these emissions, we can then use dispersion models that take into account meteorology and provide an estimate of what the concentrations of different pollutants are along the Houston Ship Channel. And with that concentration data, we can have we have an epidemiologist who's working on this project. She can then take information about ambulance visits, about acute cardiovascular events that are happening along the Houston Ship Channel, and see if there's potential reason to be concerned about the concentrations of air pollutants and outcomes that are health outcomes that are potentially affecting the communities in Houston. And it's important to note, I think Michigan has something similar, but Houston has no zoning laws. And so residents are living next door to petrochemical facilities, next door to the Houston Ship Channel, where there's all this traffic. And so through studies like this, we're really trying to make the case on why these ship emissions, why it's important to have this information, and what that means for communities that live nearby. So,
and that's a study that is pretty unique to Houston, right? But the idea would be to replicate it elsewhere?
That's right. We're hoping that, you know, similar to other data sets that can be used, this could be applicable to New York, New Jersey, and I assume AIS is required in the Great Lakes as well. So these types of studies that use these new data sets in a new way could really help communities, neighborhoods understand what it means. We think of ports as these economic engines, and they are. They bring a lot of economic benefits to the communities that live near them, but there may be a big cost. Those engines may be actually pretty dirty, and so we really just want to make sure that everyone understands the true impacts, and decisions can be made that could potentially guide technologies to be innovated that improve the outcomes for health in these fence line communities.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Christina, one of the challenges that I've had is getting people to understand the impact, because most people outside of this room don't know what a pound of NOx is or a kilogram of CO2. And you mentioned quantify it in terms of the health effect. Do you think that is the most understandable way for people to see the impact of air pollution, or what have you found?
That's a really great question. I think that it does certainly, it's a visceral understanding. If I know that if I go outside on a high ozone day, that my elderly neighbor, there's a real potential for her to have a cardiac arrest or have to call an ambulance. You know, that's much higher, that risk. I would say diving a little bit deeper into what it's costing us, again, in the pocketbook. We are, in Oakland, we've done some work where we're trying to help people understand what insurance companies see. If you live in this neighborhood, what does that mean for your health insurance premium? What does that mean for the health insurance company who is supporting your wellness and health. And so that's where I think it's much more, I think the messaging is much clearer and much stronger if we can bring that back around, not only to the health outcomes, but even more so back to what that means economically again. People really seem to understand, what it's going to mean for them in terms of their pocketbook, but also those health stories are important as well. But you're right about a pound of Knox. We think of that all the time, but to a layperson, that means nothing.
Right. Okay. Thanks.
And I also think that the industries that work in that exhaust plume, we have to engage those. So if you scientific research vessels, those are predominantly diesel-fueled engines that are, the exhaust from those stacks is raining down upon the scientists in their white Tyvek suits on the aft deck. Commercial fishermen work in the exhaust plume. People in the tugboat industry and the ferry boat industry where there is direct exposure to known carcinogens. I think that's one way to get people more motivated, and maybe we need to engage those industries, those unions, to make sure the health hazards are well understood.
So the benefit, obviously, of transitioning away from the current fuels that we use would be significant reductions in air pollutants, SOx, NOx, and greenhouse gas emissions. But I wondered if you all could talk a bit about sort of the challenges related to hydrogen, for example, the sort of green versus brown hydrogen, and then life cycle emissions from biofuels as well.
Yeah, sure. So what Maria is alluding to is the fact that you don't just have hydrogen. It doesn't come out of the ground. You have to make it. And today, about 90% of the hydrogen is made out of natural gas. So you take natural gas, react it over a catalyst, and you get hydrogen. That's a very efficient process, and that's how all the oil industry gets it, the fertilizer industry gets it, pretty much everybody. They've done studies in California on looking at fuel cell vehicle emissions, complete life cycle, they call well to wheels. You guys, I'm sure, are familiar with that. Even including that, it's called steam methane reforming, SMR process. It's still a lower emissions overall than using a gasoline engine, partly because a fuel cell is at least twice as efficient as the small gasoline engines that are in your car. So you need less of the fuel to go the same distance. So you kind of make up that pollution through higher efficiency. It's more challenging in shipping because shipping engines are bigger and they're more efficient. And in some cases, the efficiency benefit of a fuel cell is gone. The big diesel engines are the same efficiency. So then it becomes more important to start looking at the upstream. We did a study at Sandia that looked at a hydrogen fuel cell ferry, compared it to an existing diesel ferry, and the life cycle emissions of the hydrogen fuel cell ferry were higher than just the straight diesel engine with the Tier 4 diesel in there. So that's not good. The only way to get a reduced emissions and the kind of reduced emissions we need is 80% or more cut in order to keep up with the growth of shipping. The only way to do that is to go to these renewable energy sources, solar, wind, depending on how you look at it, nuclear, it doesn't affect air at least, hydropower. So these things are ways to make hydrogen with the technology is there that is green. I was at this conference in Norway this week and they were talking about black hydrogen, gray hydrogen, and Statoil or Equinor now was calling that blue hydrogen, and then there's green hydrogen. So
I think I just invented brown hydrogen. Yeah, brown then. Hydrogen. Maybe I meant black hydrogen.
So I don't know. But and then somebody else said there's no such thing as zero, right? I mean, even a solar panel, depending on how you look at it, creates some kind of emissions during that. Well, we're all creating some kind of emissions. So anyway, the I guess the last thing is I want to say on that, you can get a fuel cell on a boat and use black hydrogen, and it will be zero at the point of use. It's hard enough to do that, that maybe we start with that. And then as the green hydrogen gets more and more available and cost-effective, the transition is seamless. You don't have to change any equipment on the boat. You're using the same exact equipment, you're just changing the source of the fuel. So it's kind of like going from a diesel engine to a biofuel. You don't have to change anything. And so I really advocate for let's getting this technology out there. Even though it's not perfect right now and the emission reduction might be small, it then has a pathway to zero.
I guess I would just share a perspective with the shipping industry. We have, it's not the same as like the trucking industry. And as we're transitioning to cleaner fuels, although some of those cleaner fuels may have other downsides, it's possible because there are fewer ships to really focus on some of those issues. And what I'm thinking about right now is a lot of times people ask us about LNG or, you know, as Joe was mentioning, the methane component of SMR for hydrogen reformation. That methane is a big concern for us. As you all know, it is 84 times the warming potential of carbon dioxide. Man-made methane is responsible for about 25% of the warming that's happening on Earth right now, and so that's a big issue. Just this summer, EDF authored a paper in Science talking about methane emissions being 60% higher than what the EPA is reporting. So this is really important that we be aware of these potential issues. All of that said, with ships where potentially there's fueling from that can be very controlled. We're not talking about going to, you know, thousands and thousands of gas stations where operators are fueling up and there's lots of evaporative emissions. We don't want those emissions to be allowed to escape. But with the shipping industry, it is pretty deliberate, and I think there's potential to really reduce those potential impacts from excess methane and such like and things like that. But we need to be so careful about making sure that we're considering all of those well to wheels or well to ship costs. And so I think that making the case for ensuring that we can get technology installed on ships that are propelling them, that's showing ship owners that it can be done, and continuing to work towards the well-to-wheels, the life cycle costs and benefits and opportunities of specific cleaner fuels, that's all work that needs to be done now. But I think there definitely is a path forward.
And especially in the biofuels front, where we look at farm to fleet, we have to look at that total equation. On the surface, biofuels have always been attractive because in the CO2 equation, they have this huge advantage over other petroleum, even natural gas. But we have to look at it holistically. There are costs to planting and to harvesting and to processing. The LG sector has a lot of merit to it because we can do that in a much smaller footprint than we could do with soybean oil, some of the sugar biodiesel. But I do think, like Chris pointed out, that it's important when we talk about emissions, it isn't just the emission off of the ship's stack, but it is the entire process. From farm to fleet, or from fuel to emissions out the stack.
So I think at this time I'll open it up to Q&A. just SEJ guidelines, the journalists speak first, and if you could please identify your name and affiliation, and then I'll repeat the question back into the microphone. Sabrina? So the question is thinking about shipping in the Arctic, where the IMO is considering a proposal to ban heavy fuel oil in the region. Is there a conversation around, rather than shipping companies just doing that, going further, right? And instead of taking half steps, going fully zero emissions. So.
Okay. I'm skeptical they'll do anything more than what's required. And right now there's nothing required, but it adds to the conversation. So there was a comment before about, I can't remember who said it, about the lifetime and the investment that goes into these ships. Well, right now, if you want to build in the cruise industry a new cruise ship, it's going to take you 10 years just to get it built because of the backlog, and then you're going to operate that ship for 30 years. So you've got to start thinking, what's the requirement going to be in 40 years from now, not next year? So having this kind of conversation about getting rid of heavy fuel oil, getting rid of black carbon, et cetera, adds to the consideration that these ship owners are trying to figure out, not from a pure I have to do it now standpoint because the regulation tells me, but I might have to do it in 10 or 20 years, so the business case tells me I need to make the decision now. So I don't think you're going to see this widespread change, but you are seeing the shipping companies and the cruise companies really thinking about this a lot more than they did before.
Thanks. Take another question.
Yes, oh, sorry. I thought that was
oh.
It.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I didn't mean to monopolize. I thought we were all going to get a turn.
No. And sorry if anyone wants to respond. That's my fault. But we'll go ahead and take the next question, and then if you want to, all you want to weigh in or not.
Okay, sorry. Again, Dan Sikowski, freelance. My understanding is in the Port of Long Beach, Port of Los Angeles, that the vessels are required to be on shore power when they're in port. I'm not sure if that's in other large ports as well, but I've seen in other smaller ports, that's not the case at all, whether it be cruise ships, cargo vessels, they're just sitting there for days spewing out emissions. Is there any movement towards increasing regulatory movement on getting more shore power?
I'll just repeat it back. The question is there any movement on getting more regulation for shore power or shoreside electricity, which is when cargo ships, rather than running their engines, will connect to the ground electricity and use that instead?
That's a great question. Outside of California, there's really not a lot going on. And as you're correct, California requires shore power or an approved technology, and there are currently two other approved technologies that could be used. The stack bonnet technologies have been approved by the ARB. With shore power, the regulatory drivers for the rest of the country are not there, but there still have been some installations. And there have been a number of hurdles with tariffs, negotiating the rates for the utilities, because plugging in a cruise ship with a lot of auxiliary loads is really a huge energy draw for the local grid. But there are some other opportunities that are happening right now, and one of those is with the Volkswagen settlement. You all may have heard about Dieselgate. There's $2.9 billion that is available through the Environmental Mitigation Trust Fund, and it's distributed throughout the states. And one of the eligible project categories is for the shoreside costs of shore power. And so in places like Texas, where Galveston sees a number of repeat callers from the cruise industry, there's a real opportunity to think about putting shore power there, especially as they're trying to expand the cruise industry. And Galveston's located right where emissions come into the Houston-Galveston-Brazoria area, and so exacerbate regional air quality issues. So there are some other levers outside of regulation that could help make the case for shore power.
Hi, I'm Genevieve Bellmaker. I'm an editor, forest editor of Monterey. I'm curious about the role of unions in either in the U.S. or the role of unions. I mean, I know a little bit about unions in the U.S., but either domestically or internationally, the role of unions in all of this, but any of you?
So the question is, what role do unions play in the United States in terms of developing or preventing policy development or things?
Any of the subjects we've touched on, I mean, the shore power, any
sure.
Where are the unions at? Are they participating? Are they...
So I'll just briefly touch on what some of the challenges I've observed happening in Southern California with the two ports that are making significant improvements with the air quality. One of the tools in the toolkit for those ports is thinking about electrifying terminals. And one of the red flags that some unions feel is when they hear about electrification technologies, they're worried about automation. And so then the automation issue becomes a labor issue. And so there can sometimes be tensions as ports are responding to their communities for air quality issues, and then also talking about how they might go about doing that if electrification and automation is on the table. But that said, that also means that there's a lot of folks talking about the opportunities for controlling a crane from inside an office and the importance of video gaming skills for that. So.
Hi, my name is Tim. I'm a freelancer. So it sounds like ports are particularly polluted areas, and it sounds like particulates are maybe more of an issue than some of the greenhouse gas emissions. But can you give a little bit of a outside the shipping industry comparison? So like, is having a port in your community like having a power plant in your community, or so like having a, you know, just a car park, or like, you know, what are some like all of the examples of that within the shipping industry compared to anything, but just some sort of other benchmark?
The question is to put the discussion about ports and air pollution into context. How does it compare to, say, a community that's near a power plant or near a car park?
That's a great question. Let me maybe just start with the greenhouse gas question. I think globally as an industry, the shipping industry would say that the greenhouse gas emissions are less than 5%. But when you come into a port, if the port's inventory looking at mobile sources, those ships are over 50% of the nitrogen oxide pollution and over 50% of the PM pollution that's happening. So stepping back a little bit, the ports are an aggregation of many, many, many diesel engines, whereas a power plant is frequently a single facility where you might use the same technology. For example, for NOx, we often use SCR, selective catalytic reduction, on trucks, on other things. That there may be a large SCR unit used at a power plant that controls it very well. at a port, that same technology, if it's being used on drayage trucks that are operating in congested conditions, the catalyst is not getting hot enough, NOx emissions are not being controlled, and so you're not getting the controls you're expecting. What the entire NOx emissions or PM emissions from a port compared to, you know, an example power plant are, I don't have those numbers off the top of my head, but I can tell you that when we were talking about the cruise industry and looking at NOx emissions specifically, trying to control putting a shore power installation in Galveston, looking at the specific calls that were there, there's the potential to reduce around 300 tons of NOx per year. And if you have a truck that you know, is maybe a mid-90s truck, and you replace it with a new diesel truck, you might be able to save probably on the order of 5 tons of NOx per year. And I don't have the PM numbers for that, but that, you know, hopefully we'll just sort of talk about some of the scaling that happens. And then all the ports across the country are so different. LA and Long Beach are orders of magnitude higher in terms of the container volume that they handle than other ports. And so with that additional cargo, there's just many more emissions.
There's a study about 10 or 15 years ago that looked at the pollution. It was either out of LA or Long Beach and compared it to power plants, cars. There was a handful of different things. The two numbers that I remember was it was roughly equivalent, and it depends on the type of pollution you're looking at, so if it's GHG or NOx or whatever. So I can send that to you or you know, see me afterwards. But it was roughly around 500,000 cars for that single port or one major power plant are the two numbers I remember. But again, that was old, so you'd want to get an updated version. But it gives you a rough idea.
Mark Schlechstein, Time Speaking in New Orleans. Sort of two things. The first one, Christina, is there a way of taking what you're doing in Houston and transferring it to the ports of New Orleans?
The question is there a way of transferring the work that EDF is doing on addressing pollution in ports and transferring it from Houston to New Orleans or other ports?
Absolutely. We're trying to work with NOLA, and we do have partnerships there. We've tried to help them, and we've been successful with bringing federal grant money to the port to replace drayage trucks. One particular project that we've done just recently that is particularly relevant for New Orleans is we partnered with the Diesel Technology Forum, which is a diesel industry trade group. But we were looking at a specific question, and that is, how old are the engines that are in tugboats, which are really important for New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, and switcher locomotives? What is the real life of those engines? Because we see that group of diesel engines as a pretty discrete population that could be addressed. It turns out for some of those engines, they're over 50 years old. They're high horsepower, and they're used an awful lot. They don't shut down often, frequently. And so that means the emissions are really, they're disproportionately high. And so what we've shared is that EPA has been projecting that the service life of those engines is 23 years. And our study with the diesel industry, who know where their engines are located and how long they've been in these vessels, estimates it to be more of 50 years. And so what that means, that creates an opportunity for funds like Volkswagen, for grant programs like the Diesel Emission Reduction Act, to address those sources. And they can do it in a very cost-effective manner. Because I do a lot of work in Texas, where where there's not a very strong regulatory environment, we're very focused on voluntary initiatives. And Texas has a very successful emission reduction program that's voluntary, but it talks about cost effectiveness. How much is it going to cost Texas to reduce a ton of NOx? And so we think about it that way. And so these TUG projects for New Orleans are very cost effective, $1,000 to $5,000 per ton of NOx. And I'm only focusing on NOx right now because that's what is the focus of what the VW settlement has been. But the PM reductions for those engines, PM is really the key driver of a lot of these health impacts. Particulate matter, sorry. Fine particulates, it's especially PM 2.5. And so just a huge opportunity for the work that we're doing to be applied in New Orleans.
And the other question I had has to do with the fact that New Orleans is going to end up with a 50-foot channel. And that's something that ports are looking at all across the nation to deal with post-Panamax ships. So as part of the environmental impact statement process for those things, has this issue even touched the surface of what the Corps of Engineers is looking at? And what are you guys doing to help push that into that equation of approving these channels?
So the question is, has the issue of ship emissions, the impact of vessels, does that factor into environmental impact statements that cities are doing, especially ports that are looking to accommodate increasingly larger ships that are kind of made to fit through the expanded Panama Canal? As anyone?
We're not actively working in New Orleans, but actually with this, I'll reach out to some of the partners I know who are to share the information about the TUG study we did, and also to share some of the, I'll find some studies. So with this post-Panamax and the deepening of channels, ports are very excited about that. There's many more containers to load and offload, but those ships are going to be in port for longer dwell times. And so the impacts to those port communities could potentially be greater. And those types of potential impacts need to be addressed in an EIS.
So there is a federal initiative under the Committee for Marine Transportation to coordinate all federal interest in projects that you're speaking of here, because it was recognized that what the EPA might be forecasting might not be well coordinated with the Army Corps of Engineers or the Coast Guard, etc. So the that working group under the Committee for Marine Transportation is, I know for a fact, is looking at the total emissions equation, which would be not only the ocean-going ships, larger ships coming into port, but all of the shore facilities, and try and develop a model for total emissions. And if that model works the way that they expect it to, you can increase channel drafts and see a resultant impact economically, but also on the emission side. So that would be another source of information. Maritime Administration, CMTS.
Yeah, Justin Curtis. I'm a freelancer based in San Francisco Bay Area. Dan's probably for Christina. I'm curious about one piece of the container logistics question, and that is, should there be more of an effort to move containers to rail sooner and avoid truck trips? Especially, I know there's been a lot of work in the ports of LA and Long Beach to reduce emissions from trucks. A lot of those trucks are owned by independent truckers. Would it be faster, rather than to wait to turn over that entire truck fleet, to put the containers on rail, which can be potentially electrified sooner as a way to reduce emissions?
So the question is about using rail, especially potentially electrified rail, to transport containers versus the drayage trucks, which are often independently operated and are a significant source of the diesel-related pollution in ports.
I think that generally most people do support the ports that have on dock rail have been pointed to as being much better for the communities. And there's a couple reasons for that. You touched on the technology piece. So switcher locomotives, as long as they have cleaner engines, Tier 4 engines, they're often in a hybrid configuration. So there's a smaller engine that's charging, you know, the generator there, and that can be much lower emissions. But if you're using a switcher locomotive that used to be a line haul locomotive from 1970, that's obviously not a good solution. The issue with the drayage trucks is they're frequently going through neighborhoods, and you get the neighborhood impact where communities see those drayage trucks, they hear the drayage trucks. Those drayage trucks are going by senior centers, schools, hospitals, and that's particularly challenging. But again, with the rail, you've got the infrastructure issue, and the fact that for to put in a mile of rail, it's quite expensive, and we've already got streets that drayage trucks can transit. I will say one more thing that I think is very exciting in terms of the technology piece for switcher locomotives is that there seems to be a new technology with rail car movers that can go on and off of rails. They have rubberized wheels, and so they have much higher tractive power, and so they're able to do the job with an electric motor that a switcher had been doing. So I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities, and we're seeing technology moving in some very old sectors.
I was curious to know if any of you have any insights on these new cargo on board vessels. Apparently they're used often in Europe, and we're starting to see some of those coming up along the Mississippi. And they're specifically built as low emission, but of course pushing, you know, 3 to 4 times more of a load.
Like containers on inland barges?
Yes.
Okay, so the question is if we're seeing more containerized shipping on inland barges going in the United States or as is happening in Europe.
Well, I know in the Great Lakes that we've long looked at that as being a way to address some of these issues. Up here we're challenged by, you know, the winter season and being shut down. The northern Mississippi also faces those same kind of restrictions. So I have not seen that up here, and I know even though those ideas have been floated a number of times, it would be a small-scale, low-impact.
We've typically referred to that as container on barge, and the Marine MARAD has a marine highway program, and specifically focused on sort of thinking about this short sea shipping as well in certain areas. So in Texas, for example, you could potentially bring containers into Port Freeport, which is down near Galveston, and then you could ship those containers to Houston, to New Orleans, other places, and not have the truck traffic in the greater Houston area. Container on barge is being considered up in the New York area for certain segments. And again, it's really to move trucks off the road. And if you find me afterwards, EDF has a program called Climate Corps. And one of the fellows in the last couple of years was placed with Port Freeport and actually did an economic analysis and emissions analysis on the benefits of doing a container on barge operation from Freeport to Houston, and I'll share that with you.
Amanda? Chuck Kornbach, Milwaukee Public Radio. Mr. Dunn, if you could start, and maybe others could join in.
Where are the Lakers at with the ships that are just on the Great Lakes? How are they doing with fuel? How are they doing with emissions? So is it different from the Salties that come in, if you will?
Sorry, just going to repeat it. The question was asking about sort of the status with regard to emissions and fuel development for the Lakers, the freighters that come into the Great Lakes, and how does that compare?
Just on the Great Lakes. Versus, and then maybe versus the ocean ones that come in, too.
Okay, right. The ships on the lakes versus the ocean-going ships that come in to the region.
Yeah, so the Great Lakes does have a rather large captive fleet, both on the Canadian side and the U.S. side. By captive, I mean vessels larger than 730 feet that could not exit the seaway. The vast majority are diesel-powered ships. There is still a percentage of bunker C steam vessels on the Great Lakes. There is an effort underway to move towards LNG, particularly with the iron ore fleet on the Great Lakes. As we talked earlier, to convert the ship is a huge capital investment. It requires repowering that vessel to a different technology. And it would also require having LNG facilities on both ends of its run. So it has been proposed to put an LNG facility at the head of the lakes, up Lake Superior, Duluth, and then one at the lower end of the lakes. They're still working on the economics of doing that. I think once that facility, if that facility is built, that we'll see more of a movement in other sectors. LNG opens up a number of different possibilities, particularly on that ore boat fleet on the Great Lakes.
So I actually apologize for not knowing this, but aren't many of the Lakers exempt from the North American Emissions Control Area requirements?
Yeah, we are.
So that means that the Lakers can burn what percentage sulfur fuel, or what type of fuel can they use?
Well, we are at low sulfur fuel levels right now.
Okay. Yeah. It's just that they're not required to do so.
That's correct.
Okay.
I wondered, forgive me.
Could you introduce yourself?
Rowan, I'm a freelancer. I live in New York. Ignorant of most things related to shipping. But I remember hearing a couple of years ago that we weren't even counting most of the sort of at sea and ocean going emissions of this sector. And so there's this phenomenon where ships are lingering at the edge of territorial waters to avoid entering into that. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about that dynamic and kind of what progress we've made towards even getting a real assessment of the level of emissions.
The question is about how do we get an accurate, kind of transparent accounting of emissions from the shipping industry, especially with vessels kind of transiting international waters, and any developments there.
Okay. So ships are required to use AIS, and AIS is actually picked up in the middle of the oceans by satellites. And so we have a pretty good idea of where they are, how long they're spending at those positions. And then we can link those ships back through unique numbers to, again, when their keels were laid and when those engines were put in. So we can get a pretty good idea of what those emissions are. And I think what you're referring to when they're standing off, certain areas, like, for example, North America, we have an emissions control area regulation in place that requires ships that are operating within 200 miles of the U.S. or Canadian coast to be using a cleaner sulfur fuel. And so at that 200-mile mark, frequently what happens is these ships switch fuels. So they've been burning the more polluting bunker fuels, and they have to switch all of their systems over to the cleaner burning fuels. So this means that they are having to carry, you know, separate fuel tanks, separate systems. And that's one of the reasons it's been really challenging on the clean fuel side, is because within a single ship, you've got a whole second duplicate infrastructure to be able to burn that cleaner fuel. So,
Using the AIS data, I've heard that other folks who analyze this tell me they can see the ships, instead of taking the most direct route now, will basically do an economic calculation that says, should I, get close to the shore, but outside 200 miles, now I'm going to go straight down, and then I'm going to cut in instead of kind of going on a diagonal, which would be faster, right? But now it's more expensive because they have to burn the more expensive fuel. Or if I'm going up and down the coast, maybe I don't just stay close to shore, but I go all the way out past 200 miles, and then I go up, and then I go back in. So there are stories of this happening, what you're talking about.
So does that mean, I'm sorry, just to clarify and follow, does that mean that basically we've got sort of, as a consequence, an unintended consequence of this emissions regulation, some trips that are actually higher emissions than they might otherwise have been?
So the question is, because of the emission control areas kind of forcing ships to use more expensive fuels, and as a result they're kind of creating longer routes to avoid that, is there kind of a net, is the net emissions kind of going up? And it seems like you all nodded.
I think we all said yes.
Yeah, but what the one mitigating factor of that is going to be the global fuel sulfur standard in 2020, or maybe it'll get pushed back. So it'll bring that global limit out on the open ocean down from 3.5% to 0.5%. So then that would sort of decrease the cost differential there, and maybe you'll see people not doing that as much.
Hi, my name is Lexi Krupp. I'm in the science journalism program at NYU, and I was wondering for
so the question is for the panelists, any story ideas they would encourage journalists to focus on within the shipping industry or particularly port communities as well?
I think there's a lot of underreporting about the potential impacts to communities near ports. But maybe one story I'll share that I think has not had the coverage it deserves. So the work we do in the Houston Ship Channel, we know of a number of different types of vessels that are transiting the Houston Ship Channel. And remember, I said this is a 50-mile long channel. Houston is the North American petrochemical capital, and there are some specialized tankers called parcel tankers. And these tankers have 30, 50 tanks in each vessel. And what they do is they come into the Houston Ship Channel, and they might stop at Terminal 1 to offload some product, and then go to Terminal 2 to load some product. And the Houston Ship Channel is very narrow, and sometimes berths are not available. And so what happens is you get a parcel tanker who comes into the Houston Ship Channel. It might take 4 hours to get up there. And then the port or the terminal where they need to call is not available, not ready for them. And so the Coast Guard gets on the VHF and says, you need to go back down to Galveston, and you need to wait. And so as a consequence of this, we're talking about unintended consequences, we've got a big hotspot that we can see with AIS data off of Galveston, and then we're also emitting all those emissions along the Houston Ship Channel, and the ship owner is paying for all of that fuel. And so if there was a way, you know, there are some economic levers, there are some environmental levers, we should be able to solve this problem.
And I can add a little bit to that. You know, we focused on technology and fuel. We can't underestimate logistics as being a one way to answer this. This idea of slow steaming has a lot of merit. If we can build economies where we can slow down the vessels to their optimum efficiency, and make that economically work. Logistics and turning around and going back and doing the same thing again, we can eliminate those kind of inefficiencies and the associated pollution that goes with it.
Do you want to add anything to stories that you think?
I just have a quick follow-up question. Is AIS data available publicly?
It is publicly available. There's a number of websites where you can log on and get that raw data.
Go to marinetraffic.com.
Well, I kind of come to the end of the panel. I'm sorry I didn't get to all your questions, but we'll stick around for you to ask them. But just to wrap up, I thought it would be kind of fun for each of you to briefly say what appeals to you most about the maritime industry, because sometimes it kind of feels like maybe there's a little bit of a wall between the land and the sea. So what do you love most about, or I guess what draws you in the most about the maritime industry or the maritime world?
I can go. I have a very easy answer here. I'm a sailor. I met my husband racing at the University of Washington. I've sailed across the Atlantic. I've raced to Hawaii. And so it's, you know, very important to me. And I've had to avoid container ships out on the ocean. So it's visceral.
I grew up on the lakes, went to Maritime Academy, sailed professionally for a number of years. It gets in your blood, I think.
I don't have a good story, but for some reason, I like it. I just want to say I'm going to leave my cards here. I'm happy to be a resource for anybody now or in the future. We can talk. Give me a call anytime. I'm still in that national laboratory mode where I'm here to help. So.
Great. Well, thank you so much, guys. Thanks.